Back together, you and I, of course, Tuesday, May 10th, 2022 edition of Connecticut Today. I wondered how high gas prices have to go before people actually change their driving habits. Can you do that, or do you just have to kind of deal with it and hope the price comes down? Fiona Farine from the Group 4 Cameron discussed National Fentanyl Awareness Day. And Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Steve Stafstrom joined us to discuss the conclusion of the latest legislative session. How about those gas prices? And again, we just heard from Andrew Krauss there in the newsroom regarding the budget that was signed into law yesterday. Actually, In the even years here in the state, it's called a budget adjustment package. But again, it's pretty much a budget to everybody out there with half a brain. And that maintains the 25-cent a gallon gasoline tax cut. That's what the state would charge until the end of the year, which is nice. It's not going to be made permanent. It's nicer, though, than going just to June 30th, and that's probably a good thing. Why? Because, man, are we taking it in the shorts here with gasoline prices. Have you seen this? Gasoline prices in the state are up 19 cents in 1 week. Yikes! How's that working for you? 19 cents by the end of the day yesterday, right around when we wrapped up our daily thing at 6. The average price of gasoline per gallon in Connecticut hit $4.32 a gallon. 19 cents up over the past week, according to AAA, just 2 cents up since Sunday. Boy, it was a lot easier on Sunday, wasn't it? When we were just paying $4.30, but then it was that extra 2 cents yesterday that made us say, screw this, I'm upset. Tracy Noble, PR Relations Manager for AAA in Greater Hartford, telling the Connecticut News Junkie, quote, it's a drastic increase. And why? Well, again, global instability following the EU's announced plan to ban Russian crude oil from the market. Again, she told the Connecticut News Junkie, quote, it's market fluctuation. Crude oil prices rose last week after the EU announced plans to ban Russian oil exports within the next 6 months. She continued, quoting again, when they made that announcement, it was like they flipped a switch. We saw the price per barrel immediately start to react. So there you go. So my question to you is, and I don't know whether or not you have any flexibility here, because if you got to drive, you got to drive, right? Some people have the luxury of working from home, which is nice. I do it sometimes. I'd much rather be in the studio. There's kind of a different vibe here being in the building, just the way you have a different vibe with your business, your employees, your bosses, your friends at work when you're there versus sitting home in your underwear. Come on, admit it, you do when you're working from home. Well, they can't see me. Sitting home in your shorts and T-shirt or whatever you wear in the privacy of your own kingdom there. And there's just a big difference. It saves you money. It does. But man, oh man, the average price of gas in Connecticut now has hit $4.32 a gallon. And think about it. That's $4.32, you know, only because that 25 cent a gallon state tax has been put on hold now till the end of the calendar year, which is nice. So let me do some quick math here. If it was $4.32 and we added that 25 cent a gallon, wow, that'd be $4.57 a gallon. Yikes. And as our buddy, our pal Mike Fox always tells us from GASDA, the Gasoline and Auto Service Dealers of America, located in Fairfield County, what did he say? Watch out for the end of June into July when the 4th of July weekend kicks in and we start the height of the summer driving season. Mike said you could see $5.50, $5.50, $6 a gallon. Good Lord. So my question today is, and I've already got a bunch of comments on this. Thank you for the folks who checked the questions out early here. On our Facebook page, facebook.com/WICC600. The average price of gas in Connecticut has hit $4.32 a gallon. Yikes. Are you trying to drive less or are you just dealing with it? Because, I guess some people, And, you know, I'll plead guilt to this one. Sometimes I'll get up and I'll go somewhere in the morning that I don't really have to go to at that point, but let me go get some coffee, and I'll run around and I'll come home. Then in the afternoon I'll do stuff, and then I'll, you know, go out again late at night or early in the evening, whatever, when I have an urge for something. I say, well, let me go shopping now. There's not that many idiots I have to put up with in the store. But are you doing less and less than that? Are you just dealing with it, or are you trying to drive less? In other words, has the pain at the pump finally gotten to you? And is there a point when it can or it will get to you? For some people, I guess it is. Maybe if you're retired, maybe you have, or you work from home, or you have such a lifestyle where you can say, you know what, let me just time all my trips in one loop. I'll get out, yeah, all right, I won't go out early in the morning or late at night. I'll go in the midday, I'll go here, 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 and then I'll come home. Instead of going out in the morning, coming home, waiting a little bit, oh, I forgot to get that, I'm going to go out. You know, have you started to really think about that and take that into account at all? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. In other words, do you have a gasoline breaking point, or a point where you say, okay, now this is a pain in the arse? I was all right with $3, $3.50, okay, $3.75. So I'm paying an extra buck a gallon. I was a couple of years ago, but now we're averaging $4.32 a gallon. I mean, what are businesses going to do? For example, if this hits $5 a gallon, let's say, which it could, and if that tax was still there, it'd be hovering close to $5 a gallon, where a couple of years ago it was $2. I'm sorry, it was, let's say, $3 a gallon, just to round it off. So, you know, at what point are we looking at that here, right? Where you say, hell, it's now costing me. Now, it always costs to get back and forth to work. That's just something that we put up with because we live a certain distance from a workplace that maybe does not allow you to telecommute unless you're sick or there's a national health emergency. But, you know, you wonder, are some of these workplaces going to say, I mean, if gas got to $5, for example, or $5.50, let's say gas, in a worst-case scenario, got to $5.50. Now, right before the pandemic kicked in, gas was about $2.50, $2.60 a gallon. I'm looking at some charts here that project what gas was 6 months, a year, year and a half, 2 years ago. So we were at a time, at a point where gas was, say, about $2.50 a gallon. Well, if it goes up to, say, $5.50, that's another $3 a gallon. And if somebody has a... If somebody has a, let's say, a 12-gallon tank, right, that would cost you an extra $36 every time you filled up, above and beyond what you're paying already to just get gas in the tank. In other words, the price increase as a commodity year to year to year is an extra $3. That's an extra $36, which means if you fill up basically once a week, you know, you're talking an extra $2,000 a year. And at what point do people ask their bosses, hey, you know, it's costing me like $7, $8, $9, $10 a day maybe to go to work in an office setting? You know, can I stay home from work? I'm telling you, I guaranteed, folks, if this continues for another month, 2 months, 3 months, and there's every kind of, you know, there's every kind of indication it may, at what point do maybe some businesses say, well, you know what, we let people work at home during the pandemic, and largely we were okay, and my workers are asking me, hey, it's costing them like $5 or $10 a day extra to come back and forth to work, $50 a week, $2,500 a year. Do I be a nice guy or a nice gal, and do I let them work from home? What is your breaking point? Have you reached your, okay, this is ridiculous point right now? And are you actually changing your habits? You know, it's one thing to cry and itch and moan about something. Ah, this is ridiculous, or it's costing me. Yeah, but are you really changing how you act or don't act with this stuff. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. It's Connecticut Today. It's a Tuesday. It is the first ever National Fentanyl Awareness Day. Today on May 10th, 2022. We've talked about the scourge of fentanyl. All the hosts here on WICC have. I have. Melissa has. Lisa has in the middays. And one of the guests that I keep bringing on the program here is a person whose family was touched by this. Fiona Farin, again, joins us. She and her husband, who's an old high school friend of mine, lost a stepson to the absolute scourge of fentanyl. But instead of sitting back, they formed the group for Cameron, and they are constantly pushing, urging people to get involved. And also, they have had some tangible success with lawmakers in the state. Fiona, hi, it's Paul again. Good to speak with you. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks, Paul. Thank you for having me on again.
Well, thank you. And it's got to be a tough day for you, Fiona, and for you and Joe, and for everyone in your family there. I mean, every day is a tough day when you lose a son to fentanyl. But I know you and the people at Fort Cameron and other groups, Fiona, you impress me because you've kept pushing and you say, listen, our son is gone, but we're going to try and make a difference here. So on a day like today, Fiona, the National Fentanyl Awareness Day, what are your thoughts? And can you give us a bit of an update on where things stand here in the state, especially with the efforts that you've made over the past few years?
Sure. So what I would say today is that it's profoundly bittersweet to go onto social media and see all the different posts of National Fentanyl Awareness Day. On one hand, you sort of breathe a huge sigh of relief that it actually is finally being recognized, because it had felt for a period of time as if, you know, this was an uphill battle. And on the other hand, you're always cognizant of the reason that you're involved in this and what's brought you here. But what I always go back to is that if there's a better way to remember somebody, a life taken, you know, unnecessarily and suddenly, what better way than to try to save other people from losing their life in this manner? So I always end up thankful, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. And Fiona, you know, me being in the news business, you being in now, I guess I would say an activist because of how your family was touched by this, you and I are constantly in tune about what is happening with fentanyl. You know, you hear it on the ground level. You've experienced it. I hear it and see it in experts I have on the show here today, like today with you and in news stories. But it's got to be a little frustrating, though, Fiona, because even though it's now top of mind, unfortunately, in a lot of the news cycles, it is still quite a lift, isn't it, as your groups have found out, to really get more action on this at the legislative and law enforcement levels?
Yes, it's very, very frustrating, because if it were anything else, Paul, that was such a pressing public health and public safety emergency, it would be being talked about on the news. It would be being talked about by your leaders every single day. But there's such a fear of learning about this issue that it is frustrating, because you're constantly pushing people just to listen or just to hear, you know, just to hear you out on it. I'm sorry, I've got terrible allergies today, like the rest of Connecticut.
Yeah.
But so it is very frustrating, Paul. I have to be honest. It almost, what it feels a bit to me as if when our children were in school, like everybody else, it was drug education awareness, right? And we said to them, if you do that, you could die.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't exactly true back then, but that's what we knew and that's what was taught, right? And now it's almost like, no, this time we really mean it. We really, really, really need you to listen to us now, because now that is the truth. It is one out of every four experimentations is going to take somebody's life.
Tragic. Fiona, hang on. We'll be right back with you. We will have more from Fiona Farin. She is part of the group for Cameron. Her son was taken from her and her husband due to a fentanyl overdose. Today, National Fentanyl Awareness Day is proclaimed by the federal government after a bipartisan bill in the Senate, co-sponsored by California Democrat Dianne Feinstein and Iowa Republican Charles Grassley. More with Fiona and her experience and how her family deals with this and what she wants to see happen straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And wherever you are right now in Connecticut or maybe in the sound of my voice via WICC600.com, you undoubtedly have heard of fentanyl, and you may have heard of an individual or family that may have been touched by this. Our guest is Fiona Farine, her and her husband, Joe, who's a longtime old high school buddy of mine. They lost a son to the scourge of fentanyl several years ago. They started to be activists in this. Congrats to them and kudos to them for the group for Cameron and other forces that they are involved with. Fentanyl, by the way, just for some numbers here, the CDC estimating that in the U.S., nearly 107,000 people died as the result of a drug overdose in the year ending November of 2021. 66% of those, two-thirds, involved synthetic opioids such as fentanyl. And Fiona, as you have found, and Joe and your family's work now with all these groups, it's tragic because, you know, some of these victims, Fiona, knew they were dealing with fentanyl, and others, from what I've been told by drug enforcement officials and police, others oftentimes don't know that they're dealing with fentanyl, correct?
That's absolutely correct. I will use our loss as an example. Cameron thought he was buying OxyContin from somebody he trusted. And indeed, he was sold three OxyContin pills, and it was unadulterated fentanyl, and they were stamped. They were actually had like a pharmaceutical Oxy 30 stamp on them. So you have people dying because they've relapsed, or they're experimenting for the first time, or whatever it is, and they think that they're getting something different from what they're getting, Paul. So we often say that actually, if we were dealing with anything else, it would be a poisoning, you know, not even an overdose in those instances, because, and there has not been enough awareness to get the word out there that this is a risk. So now we have one of the greatest public health emergencies of our lifetime.
What, Fiona, in your working with officials and health and law enforcement officials, what do they say when approached with maybe the questions that you and Joe and many people have? Why would a dealer do this? In other words, your late son wanted oxycodone, and we've all dealt with that, maybe medicinally, but why would a drug dealer, as if we have to get into the mind of a criminal, why would they do something and then hide it? Is it an effort to get a person hooked? I have never understood that.
No. You know, it's even darker than that, Paul. So the thing is that illicit fentanyl is so inexpensive compared to other substances that we've created a market of opportunity that is almost, it's so lucrative that I think from a dealer perspective, they almost cannot resist the temptation at this point. You're talking pennies on the dollar. So they are cutting as many drugs as they can with the illicit fentanyl that's literally pouring in around us, right? It's coming through the U.S. mail. I mean, I speak to our Connecticut U.S. attorney. It's coming through the U.S. mail in record numbers. Now people are figuring out how to compound it themselves. So it's being cooked up in kitchens. And these are not pharmacists, Paul. It's illicit. So it's unstable batches. You know, some of it is just going to be in a drug and people won't even know they had it. And others are going to die instantly because they're not pharmacists. So it's not compounded accurately. And so we really have a really urgent and dire situation.
So your group and the folks you're involved with, you were able to get some changes in Connecticut laws over the past couple of years. That's to be commended. What is next, Fiona, on the radar for folks like you and your family and groups like For Cameron who want to see the state or the feds come down even tougher on this? What is next on your to-do list here?
So next on our to-do list is we did work really hard and get an act through that we're now waiting for the governor to sign into law, which is HB 5430, which was a bipartisan act concerning opioids. And we got some initiatives through on that. We didn't get all initiatives that we asked for through, but it's a great start. So next on our list, Paul, is going to be in the next legislative session, for Cameron Board strongly wants a fatal overdose task force in the state of Connecticut that will be designated to handling just these cases, just in the same way that there are, you know, gun violence task force that are sworn in members. And we do have a lot of interest in that. So that will be one of the initiatives that we will be pushing hard for. The other thing we want to see is we will not let up the pressure. We want awareness, and we want people to start getting through to parents. Parents need to not push this information away, as this won't happen to us. They need to start paying attention. So that means there needs to be a lot of awareness in schools and what other forums you can get. And we need our legislative leaders to be willing to talk about this.
The website forcameron.com, forcameron.com. They are a nonprofit, so check them out there. They're on Facebook as well and social media. Fiona Farine, Fiona, it is always good to have you on. Thank you so much. Tell Joe I said hi, send my love, and whatever I can do here to continue this, just get a hold of me. No problem.
Thank you so much, Paul. Always appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Fiona Farine and her husband, Joe, a high school buddy of mine that we still keep in contact. Cameron, their son, lost his life unsuspectingly. As Fiona just said, he thought he was buying, you know, simple, if there ever can be, opioid, but fentanyl, much of it is synthetic, and it was mixed in with something he was doing, and he lost his life. So again, slowly but surely now, through groups like For Cameron and other groups that are involved in this, change is happening. But if you can, check them out, folks. For, F-O-R, Cameron, C-A-M-E-R-O-N, forcameron.com. Well, the legislative session wrapping up after a whole bunch of guys and gals got together to talk about a lot of key issues, the budget, mental health, different regulations, criminal justice, just a bunch of stuff taken care of in the short session. And joining us right now to talk about that, give us kind of a session wrap-up from the Democratic side, State Rep. Steve Staftrum joins us of Bridgeport, and also Steve chairs the Judiciary Committee, the General Assembly's Judiciary Committee, which had a lot to do this past session. Steve, is Paul here? Good afternoon, sir. How you been? How are you?
Hey, good, Paul. Good to talk to you.
And, boy, kind of a busy session, Steve, I would imagine, with all these different competing high-profile bills up there. Must have been some long days and nights. And how difficult is that, Steve, for any legislator to kind of keep your ducks in a row when so much of this thing, these things, and you all get it done in the end, but so much of this happens in a relatively compressed time frame?
Yeah, I think it is. It is certainly a race. You know, really the first, I would say, two-thirds of the session we spend in our various committees and kind of working on the issues that come before our committees. As you mentioned, I chair Judiciary, so, you know, that's 95% of my focus for a lot of the session. And then, you know, once you get towards the later part of the session, that's when everybody kind of comes back together. The various committees report on their bills, and there has to be a prioritization of what can actually get done before that clock strikes midnight on the last night.
Of course, one of the biggest bills, Steve, this year, other than the budget adjustments, and we'll get to that, was the justice bill, the crime bill aimed at juvenile justice. And you and another friend of the program here, Craig Fischbein, the ranking member on Judiciary, you and Craig got together, and I know you heard from disparate people all around the state, and a lot of people like this, a lot of people don't like that, the far edges of both parties, the centrists in both parties. Steve, I get the impression from what you've said publicly and what I've heard from Craig and others that this is one of those bills where you get done what you can get done. And, you know, like, I guess, being a baseball umpire, not everybody's happy, but there were some things that I think are positive in this bill.
Yeah, I think what it's important for folks to know is Connecticut has largely avoided sort of what we've seen in D.C., where everything has to necessarily be partisan. And if I don't get 100% on what I want, then it's a bad bill. You know, even though Craig and I come from pretty different ideological perspectives and don't always agree on every issue, we're actually pretty close friends. And so when push comes to shove, we can get in a room and we can say, look, here's what my caucus can live with. He can say, here's what my caucus can live with. I can push and prod and say, I'd like this in a bill, and he can do the same. And at the end of the day, we both were able to sort of agree to take half a loaf on this. And I think the state of Connecticut is better as a result of that.
Yeah, and some of the things, Steve, I did read in this bill, the expanded use of ankle monitors when deemed, a little more flexibility for holding, multi-time offenders as juveniles, the changes in how car thefts are assessed. And, Steve, I say on this show all the time, I don't want to put anybody in jail, any kid, you know, wrong place at the wrong time. You don't put kids in jail for breaking a window or stealing a crate of candy bars. But I think that people are going to be pretty happy, Steve, at least some things that were done, because there are some pretty high profile issues, Steve, that were voiced, as you probably heard, by many police chiefs around the state.
Yeah, and data shows and study after study shows that actually putting a kid in jail has an inverse effect. You would think that that would, all right, kid's going to learn his lesson, he's not going to do it again. That's actually not the case. What we have shown, what we've seen, is the more services, the more intervention, the more counseling, the more support, those are the things that changes behaviors. And so even though the juvenile justice bill, the judiciary passed, focused on the topics you mentioned, it is important to also look at the state budget, which does include, you know, tens of millions of dollars in new funding for support and services to keep kids not just from getting in trouble the first time, but really from recidivating and leading a life of crime, right? You know, I think we can all agree that a kid commits a crime once, particularly at a young age. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to figure out what's causing that kid from doing it and stop him from doing it again. And that's really what we're focused on. And you're right, the juvenile justice bill does have some additional tools in the toolbox for that kid who's a repeat offender. You know, I, as I'm sure you know, you know, I took a lot of flack from my left, from some mm-hmm. of the more progressive sure. members of my caucus on the ankle bracelet piece. And the reason I sort of signed off on that was it is a tool to keep kids out of prison in many respects, because what it does is it gives the judge the option of saying, okay, you know, you've stolen a second car now, I'm going to release you back out into the community with this ankle bracelet on, in lieu of time in prison. Mm-hmm. And I think that is why a judge having the discretion to use those tools is so important.
Steve, hang on. We'll come back. We'll talk about the budget and all that money that is flowing into Hartford or came in via taxes and federal money and what you folks decided to do with it. Bridgeport State Rep. Democrat Steve Staftram is the guest. He chairs the General Assembly's Judiciary Committee. More with Steve coming up first. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we continue with Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Steve Staftram giving us kind of a wrap-up of the short legislative session as we're in an election year. Steve also chairs the Judiciary Committee for the General Assembly, but we go from matters judiciary to matters of the budget. And Steve, I know a big discussion among all the party leaders up there in the governor's office was, hey, we've gone from red ink to copious amounts of black ink here. How to spend this, what to spend it on, what do we do with tax cuts? And I know the governor, Steve, has been very staunchly in favor of paying down some of the long-term debt, the obligations the state has. Do you agree with the relative percentages that are going to that after the budget?
Oh, absolutely. I think if anything, we should have put more money into paying down our debt. When I first came into the General Assembly in 2015, we had a $3 billion deficit. This year, we not only have $3 billion sitting in our bank account, the rainy day fund, not only were we able to give back to the taxpayers $600 million in direct targeted property tax and other relief, but paying down the two, it could be upwards of $3 billion that we're going to pay in pension debt, has a huge long-term effect, not just in terms of business confidence and the ability to attract businesses going forward, but really allows us to sustain the tax cuts that we've made, and in fact, to save money in out years. I mean, one of the stats I've seen says the money we put down this year will translate into $300 to $400 million in savings every budget year starting next year and then going forward. So think of it like paying a little extra on your mortgage, right? The more you pay now, the less you have to pay down the road. And we have huge unfunded pension liabilities in the state. It is a sink on our economy and really is the single most important thing we can be putting money towards.
Are you confident, Steve, that in the out years coming up 2, 3, 4 years down the road, I mean, I know we could always make adjustments, but are you confident that we won't return, barring anything crazy in the world, to a large flow of red ink, or is that just something we've got to keep an eye on?
I think, knock on wood, we should be okay for a while. Paying down the pension debt every year that we do that helps, because I think what folks don't realize is a lot of the red ink comes from the fact so much of our budget is put towards paying down that and paying off those pension obligations. You know, we actually don't have, and I know some folks would probably quibble with me on this, but if you look at our state employee base vis-a-vis other states, our current employees, we actually do not have a very fat, bloated state government. Mm-hmm. We did at one point, and we are paying for that now. And that's where a lot of the money goes to, is to paying for those legacy obligations. So the more we can pay down, the better shape we're going to be long term. No different than, like I said, you pay off that credit card.
All right. Finally, Steve, this is the short session we have. Elections coming up in November, and I'm assuming that you'll be reelected again as one of the leaders. And if you are, going into next year, and I know you guys and gals always think about stuff that we couldn't get to this year because of the compressed time frame, which, I've railed on this show, drives me crazy. I think it should be longer, but that's another discussion for another day. So what were you not able to get to this time around, Steve, that you're saying, okay, next year, once we clear the elections and turn into 2023, this is going to be a major point of contention for me, or something I'm going to push? Have you thought about that? What one or two issues do you really want to lay into next year?
Yeah, I think, look, Paul, we continue to need to make sure we're investing in our economy in the state. And we have been a beneficiary through the pandemic of kind of a return to a suburbanization. We've seen an influx of new residents. We've seen an influx of new revenue. We've seen an influx of businesses as there's been sort of a flight out of the cities and into the suburbs. That trend, I think, will continue for a period of time, but it's not going to continue forever. And so, I first ran for office really saying we need to invest in our urban cores. We need to make sure that we have dynamic, livable, walkable cities that attract residents and jobs. And I think we have not done enough over the last couple of years sort of on direct urban investments into creating economic opportunity in our cities, and we need to continue to do that.
Yeah, Stephen, off that, finally, if I can add one other thing, you see, this is a pet peeve of mine, too. You talk about, right, wanting to invest in the cities, Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford, New London, Danbury, Waterbury, and you see, Steve, all these great new apartment complexes moving in there and say, wow, this is really nice, self-contained living. And then, Steve, and you probably do this too, I look at the rents of these places and I'm like, well, this is nice, but can a lot of working class Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford people, afford that? And hopefully I'd like to see you guys and gals get on that a little more. I don't know what you do with this because, developers and condo and apartment owners will charge what the market can bear. But, I'd love to see, Steve, more really nice modern living, a little bit more affordable for city dwellers.
Some of that is happening, particularly if you look in the south end of Bridgeport, where sort of the old Marina Village was and the redevelopment down there. Some of it is happening downtown with the set aside of some of the development of kind of the North Main Street area downtown that is turning over. But you're right, it's not everywhere. You know, if you come to my neck of the woods in Black Rock, you see the massive development going up by the train station where the old movie theater used to be. And, you know, those are going to be the most expensive apartments in the city of Bridgeport when they're built, you know, real high-end residential luxury apartments. And so it's not uniform, that's for sure.
State Rep Steve Stafford. Steve, good to chat with you. Take care, and we'll talk down the road and enjoy the break. Thank you.
Take care, Paul.
Appreciate it. Steve Stafford joining us to wrap up the legislative session right here on WICC.